offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode, the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and I have this opportunity to come live to you from our studios in Prashanthi Nilayam. This is a program where we together go through the Bhagavad Gita, and we have completed 6 chapters, which means we are 1/3 down the way of completing the Bhagavad Gita, and it's been a wonderful journey. I see this every week. I cannot thank you all enough for your company. I cannot thank you all enough for the wonderful feedback that I get ever so often from all of you, and it means a lot. Some of the feedback does point out some things that I probably must have missed out, or some better way of explaining it, and I'm definitely very thankful for that, because as I always maintain, I'm not someone who has read the Bhagavad Gita over and over again. I'm not an expert in this. I am traveling in this journey along with all of you, and I'm exploring this wonderful text along with all of you, and so any kind of feedback, especially constructive, is always welcome. As always, we'll begin with a short summary of what we covered last week, and we'll take it from there. I completed the summary of the last part of the 6th chapter. That was the first thing that we did. And then we started the 7th chapter. The 7th chapter is called Jnana Vijnana Yoga, which is derived from the name, or from what Krishna himself says in the 2nd shloka, and we'll be coming to that in our summary, as well as in what we're going to be talking later in this episode as well. Before that, I give you a short summary of the chapter itself. We discussed how there is a certain change in the subject matter of the discourse at this point. The first 6 chapters of the Gita focused on the individual, on the Jivatma. Starting from this chapter, Krishna is going to explain God, so to say, or going to explain the nature of God. In other words, the first 6 chapters are about the Tvam aspect, and now he's going to speak about the Tat aspect, if we were to look at it from the point of view of the Mahavakya, Tat, Tvam, Asi, that thou art, right? So the first 6 is about thou. The following chapters are going to be about that. And almost pretty much it is going to culminate in the 12th chapter. And of course, I also said that this is only a division for us to look at. And there's a certain change in subject. But Krishna always spoke about God also in the first 6 chapters. He's going to continue to speak about the Jivatma also in the following chapters. But you can see the tone of the discourse is undergoing a marked change in this manner. We saw how Krishna concluded the previous chapter by saying that the yogi who is centered on him is greater than all other yogis, right? After telling Arjuna that you should be a yogi, he completes the chapter by saying that that yogi who is always focused on me, who is always centered on me, that yogi is greater in my opinion. So there is that unasked question as to why is that so? What makes such a yogi better than all the other yogis? So in the very first shloka of the 2nd chapter, in the 7th chapter, Krishna begins by addressing this unasked question. Krishna says, Mai asakta manaha, with mind focused on me, madashrayaha, taking refuge in me, yogam yunjan, practicing yoga. So we saw a very beautiful explanation that Adi Shankara gives for these two terms, mai asakta manaha and madashrayaha. The word ashraya means refuge, to take refuge in someone, but the word ashraya also means the path that one takes to achieve the goal that one has set out to reach. So when Krishna says madashrayaha, mat ashraya, it refers to the person for whom the goal is God and the means or the path also becomes God. So that's a very beautiful description of a devotee or a bhakta. And for such a person, mai asakta manaha. When your goal is God, when your path is God, then your mind is automatically fixed on God alone. It is attached to God. That is what Krishna says, that such a person, his mind is constantly engaged in me. And this way, he says, you will know God, and you will know God as he is, or in his true form, in his entirety. Samagram ma nyasyasi. You will know me in my entirety, Krishna says. So this was the first shloka where he says, you might ask me why a person who is attached to me is greater. This is why, because such a person gets to know me completely. In the next shloka, in the second shloka, Krishna says, jnanam sa vijnanam idam. This jnanam with vijnanam, aham vakshyami. I will clarify to you. Te asheshataha. In full to you. So this is the statement from where the chapter gets its name, because Krishna clearly declares that I am going to teach you jnanam and vijnanam. That's why it is called jnana vijnana yoga. We also discussed how when jnana alone is mentioned, it invariably means supreme knowledge. But when we say jnana vijnana, jnanam vijnanam, it refers to knowledge that is paroksha and aparoksha. Knowledge which is indirect and which is direct or experiential. So when jnana becomes one's own experience, that is referred to as vijnana. So when Krishna says, I'm going to teach you jnana and vijnana, it means that what Krishna is going to explain can be found in some scriptures as indirect knowledge, as bookish knowledge. The word paroksha itself means to know through the eyes of another, right? Paroksha jnana means to be able to see through the eyes of another person. So some of what Krishna is going to explain can be found in other scriptures by authored by other great sages and thinkers, but some part of it is aparoksha. Of course, when we talk of Krishna and aparoksha jnana, it is not Krishna's experiential knowledge, because Krishna is knowledge himself. But what Krishna is going to say is probably so direct that it cannot be found in scriptures, right? And finally, Krishna says that once you know this, there is nothing to be known at all, right? So in all of these, what Krishna is emphasizing and establishing is, what I am saying is important, pay attention. In fact, the next shloka, the third shloka, also this tone continues before the discourse on jnana and vijnana actually begins. So we listen to the third shloka of the seventh chapter also. I'll give you a brief meaning of that. And then I will probably discuss a little these three shlokas together, what Krishna is conveying in the first three shlokas of the second chapter. So we listen to the third shloka in the voice of Brother Shyam as always, and then I'll give you a brief meaning, and then we'll discuss further.
Manushyanam sahasreshu kaschid yatati siddhaye yatatamapi siddhanam kaschinmam feti tatvatah.
Among thousands of men, a rare one endeavors for perfection. Even of the perfected ones who are diligent, one perchance knows me in truth. So this is the third shloka of the seventh chapter. As I was just saying, the first three shlokas of this chapter are preparatory in nature. It is preparing the mind of Arjuna to be more receptive and preparatory even for you and me, right? The two verses that we saw last week and this one, Krishna is trying to convey to Arjuna that what he is going to say is very important and possibly, as we just discussed, is unique and is not probably likely to be found elsewhere. this shloka also has to be seen in that light, or else it might seem a little demotivating. I'll explain why. But before that, we'll see what exactly Krishna is saying here. We'll go through the word by word meaning. Krishna says, Manushyanam sahasreshu. Out of thousands of people, kaschit yatati siddhaye. Some one person strives for perfection. Yatati siddhaye means striving for siddhi or the ultimate success. When you place your ambition on something and you achieve that, it means that I have attained it. That goal becomes siddhi, right? So yatati siddhaye means you are putting effort to attain a certain goal. And here the goal that we are talking about is the ultimate success or moksha. So Krishna says the proportion of people who strive for this ultimate goal is 1:1,000. 1 in 1,000 people turn to having this ultimate moksha as their goal in life. Then he goes on to say, Yatatam api siddhanam. Even of those striving perfect beings, kaschit mam vetti. Some one person knows me, tattvatah, in essence, as I really am. The word tattva we have discussed many times before. So Krishna is saying that among thousands of worldly people, one person turns to a spiritual path, and yetatam api siddhanam. Among these perfected beings, only few turn to me or turn to me and understand me in my reality. But before we move on, this particular statement that Krishna is making here, yetatam api siddhanam, this is a statement that we can look a little bit more, and it is actually slightly confusing, so we'll just spend a little time in that. In the first statement, Krishna said, Manushyanam sahasreshu kaschiti yatati siddhaye. Among thousands, one person makes effort for perfection. So once he or she attains perfection or attains the goal, then they are referred to as siddhas, right? Yatati siddhaye means you are making effort to reach siddhi. Siddha means you have attained that siddhi, right? So they have achieved what they have set out to achieve. If we were to take that meaning for the word siddha, then the next line that Krishna says, yatatam api siddhanam, that becomes among those who have made effort and have achieved the ultimate goal, kaschit mam vetti tattvatah. Only few know me. But that will suggest that there are two goals to be reached. One is that of perfection, and the other is that of knowing the Lord in His tattva. But it is not to be seen this way, because Krishna has already said that He is going to talk of that knowledge acquiring which you don't have to know anything. So that knowledge that He is talking about is one. It is once you know that, you know God, you know you have attained perfection, there is nothing more to seek, there is nothing more to become, there is nothing more to achieve, right? So when Krishna says, yatatam api siddhanam, here he is referring to those who have made moksha their goal. The moment you become a student, you are being referred to by the effort that you are putting in. The moment you become a student of medicine, you are called a medico, right? You have not yet become a doctor, but now you are being defined by your pursuit. Like a karma yogi, even a perfect jnani who performs his or her actions with enlightenment can be referred to as a karma yogi. You and me who are taking baby steps in this path of karma yoga can also be referred to as karma yogi. So what Krishna says here so becomes among thousands. Of course, once again, though Krishna says Manushyanam Sahasreshu, which means among 1,000 people, it's specific, right? Sahasreshu means among 1,000 people. But the word Sahasra in Sanskrit is always used to refer to a multitude or a number of people or a number of things, right? It is not Sahasra means thousand, but Sahasra is also referred to as a large number, right? Swami would often say this when you praise God in Purusha Suktam as Sahasra Shirsha, Purusha Sahasrakshas, Sahasrapat. Swami would say it does not mean that Lord has exactly thousand heads, thousand eyes and thousand limbs. It means He has innumerable heads, eyes and limbs. So this is not even a simple ratio in that sense. It is not 1:1,000. It is among thousands, one person turns to spirituality. Similarly, what we had spoken of as Lord Yama's words to Nachiketa in the Kathopanishad. He says, a few brave adventurous ones, Kaschid Dhira, turn their quest inward, turn to spirituality. And Krishna says, among thousands of such people who turn to the spiritual path, who have taken moksha as their goal, among thousands, one attains supreme knowledge, which is knowing me in my tattva. So the question is, why is Krishna discouraging us by saying this? We want the teacher to give us confidence, isn't it? We don't want the teacher to come and tell us that, you know, the success rate in this exam is very low. Even before we begin the course, even before we take the exam, we don't want the teacher to come and demotivate us like that, right? In fact, we used to have a teacher who would proudly come and tell us in the very first class of the semester, he would say that, you know, every year at least 10 people failed in my paper. And he would say it with a triumphant smile. And people like me, the moment we would hear that, we would right away get demotivated. That is why I think these three shlokas have to be seen together, and these have to be seen as to what is Krishna conveying in these shlokas. These introductory shlokas should be seen in a certain manner. In the previous shloka, Krishna says, I am going to teach you that by learning which you don't have to learn anymore. Yata nyatva na iha bhuyaha anyata nyatavyam avasishyate. Sometimes in a class, the teacher would come and tell, the concept I'm going to teach today is very important. If you understand this concept well, then you will be able to understand the rest of the subject very easily. What will happen when the teacher comes and tells such a statement, makes such a statement in a class? Instantly we will all become all ears, isn't it? We will stop fooling around and we'll start paying attention. So Krishna's tone has to be seen as that, as one that is trying to draw undivided attention from Arjuna and from you and me, right? He also made that important point that he is going to teach jnana and vijnana. And that was the suggestion that the knowledge that is going to be imparted is not probably available in any textbook. You know, when we have many means to know or many means to learn, why will we pay attention to the teacher? Only if what is going to be said is going to be so unique that you're not going to find it in a textbook or in a YouTube video or in a tutorial elsewhere, then you will start paying more attention to the teacher. Right? That's one of the problems you have in modern education, because most of the students will have their own private tuition, and that will reflect in the way they pay less attention to the teacher in the class. But see what Krishna is saying. First thing he says is, what I'm going to teach you is jnana and vijnana. You might find some of it in some scriptures, but some of it is vijnana. It is direct knowledge. You will not find it in other books. And then he says that what I'm going to teach, knowing this, you will know everything. It is a way of saying that this concept is very critical. If you understand this, you will be able to understand everything else. So pay attention. And then he's saying that what I'm saying, so when you see this whole, whatever Krishna is saying in this backdrop, what Krishna is saying in this shloka is not to scare Arjuna or any of us, but to say that you have come to this point of listening to this discourse, and that itself is great. Not many do that. Right? When Krishna says, among thousands, one turns to the spiritual path. So if you and I stand in the cusp of a spiritual journey or are trying to take steps on the spiritual path, it means that it has taken us so much effort to come to where we are. Right? And in the previous chapter, Krishna also promised that once you take to the path of yoga, if not today, if not tomorrow, if not in this birth, in some birth you will reach the goal. And probably that will lead to a little bit of a lackadaisical attitude in a student. When you tell a student, suppose your student joins your class and you say, don't worry, you will never fail. There is no way you're going to fail in this paper. There's a possibility that student might become a little less attentive, right? So much part of the previous chapter's end was about Krishna saying that once you become a yogi, you are never going to fall. You might be a yoga bhrashta, but you'll always be moving ahead in this path. But then Krishna is saying here, a yogi never fails. He or she will always progress on the path, but that doesn't take away the truth that this path is difficult. Because a few thousands, one person takes to it. Only one is successful of a few thousands that eventually take to it. But Krishna is telling Arjuna, you have this opportunity of listening from me. You're having this opportunity of being guided by me directly. And I am capable of giving you jnana and vijnana. So Arjuna, pay attention to what I am saying. Right? Before we move to the next shloka, and from where this exclusive wisdom that Krishna has been quote-unquote marketing to Arjuna is going to actually start, let me just raise one more question. Why is this path difficult? Why do so many people fail? First of all, why is it that among thousands only one takes to the spiritual path? And even after thousands take to the spiritual path, only one becomes successful. Why is that? If we really look close, what we seek from the world is actually not any different from what we seek on a spiritual path or in the spiritual journey. Generally, the idea is the worldly person and the spiritual person want different things. That's what defines a worldly and a spiritual person. But in my opinion, I think that is not the case. Both seek the same thing. Both seek peace and happiness, but they seek it in different places, or the means that they take to achieve that peace and happiness is different. The worldly person seeks it in the world. The spiritual person seeks it, or at least is supposed to seek it, beyond the world. It's somewhat like a patient who is, say, suffering from painful symptoms of a certain disease. All want relief, but some try to suppress the symptoms or try to have relief from the symptoms. But there are some people who try to endure the symptoms and try to seek a cure that will get rid of the symptoms completely, right? For the person who wishes for a permanent cure, sometimes a little bit of endurance is required. You have to put up with that pain of symptoms sometimes. You cannot always try to duck the symptoms or suppress the symptoms. And I think that is the reason people fail when we are talking about the spiritual path. At some point, the mind gives up and goes after that which gives easy relief. Like, we would rather take painkillers than go through the entire treatment, which means that you have to put up with the pain. Even though the relief may not be permanent and it may sometimes even lead to some other issues, like you have these, the most common issue in the West of opioid addictions. You know that you trying to suppress the symptoms and looking for immediate short-term relief is going to get you into more trouble, but then you're not strong enough to look beyond the pain. You might rather have immediate relief than putting up with this pain and a permanent cure later, right? So it calls for a certain mental strength to look beyond the happiness of the world, the relief of the world, and look for true lasting happiness, true lasting freedom. And all through this process, the world is right there and it's tempting you all through this journey, right? It is all the time there in front of you, tempting and trying to distract you from this journey that you have taken as a spiritual aspirant. And that is why Swami says, for this journey, one needs faith and devotion. Because only from faith and devotion, you will get that endurance to look beyond this pain and seek true happiness beyond the world. So Swami says, in this journey, what is required is Shraddha Bhakti, faith and devotion. When there is Shraddha Bhakti, one will also have the ability to stick to the path. Before we move ahead, I'd like to read out a small portion from Swami's Gita Vahini, where Swami explains this point, and the reason this point is important is it also sets the context for the rest of the chapter, and it explains why Krishna is speaking about the nature of the Supreme Lord. So I'll read out this particular passage from Swami's Gita Vahini. This is from chapter 11, and I will explain that, and then we'll move on to the other shlokas. Swami writes, and I quote, "The yogas of meditation and wisdom are both inner disciplines. They are based on Shraddha Bhakti, faith and devotion. Without these two, both yogas are unattainable. The pursuit itself is vain. An aspirant deprived of them is like a wooden doll, lifeless, unaware of the goal. The basic requisite is deep-rooted love towards the Lord. How can you get this? By getting to know the glory, the splendor, the nature and characteristics of the Lord. His essential nature, Swabhava, and reality, Swarupa. That is why I am instructing you about these. I am imparting to you fully the wisdom of the scriptures, supplemented by the wisdom of inner experience. Know that there is nothing further for you to know. Of the thousands of aspirants, few strive to acquire this wisdom, and of these, only some single individual achieves success. All who start do not reach the goal." End of quote. So that's the passage from Gita Vahini chapter 11, and the last few lines is Swami explaining just the shloka that we went through. But here, very beautifully, Swami explains that this is an internal path, a nivritti marga. Swami would say the worldly path is pravritti marga, the spiritual path is nivritti marga, a path that takes you inward. So to not be distracted by what is outside, Swami says one needs Shraddha and Bhakti. For Shraddha Bhakti, one must have love for God. And love for God can be developed if one makes an attempt to understand God's true nature. God's Swabhava and Swarupa. These are two important words. We'll discuss them as we go forward. And Swami clearly says that what we have been discussing about Jnana and Vijnana, very beautifully he says that I've decided to give you Shastra Jnana with Anubhava Jnana of the Swarupa and Swabhava of God. So yes, this path is difficult, but this also means we have come a long way to be here. We have come a long way to be even listening to this discourse. Swami would say, we have crossed 84 lakh lives in different species and thousands of lifetimes. After having been born as human beings, we have spent in worldly pursuits, and now we have this opportunity to be recipients of the knowledge and to be recipients of the knowledge from Swami himself. Look at Arjuna's good fortune, right? Many, many lakh species as different animals and beings and fish and birds and beasts and everything. And then thousands of lifetimes as human being in worldly pursuit, right? Because when Swami says that among thousands one turns to spirituality, it also means among thousands of lives or after thousands of lives, in one life you turn to a spiritual goal. And probably thousands of lives after being a spiritual aspirant or partly worldly and partly spiritual, right? That's what a yoga bhrashta is. Starts off as a yogi but then loses his way or loses her way through this journey, right? Maybe after thousands of lives with putting in effort in the spiritual path, finally Arjuna has come to a point where he is able to listen to this discourse directly from Krishna himself. Same is the case with you and me. After how many lifetimes we have come to this cusp of this grand opportunity of being students at Swami's feet, right? We all are students at Swami's feet. We are learning the spiritual journey, what we are supposed to do. Every step we are learning from Swami, how fortunate we all are, right? Not only to receive knowledge from Swami, but also the faith and confidence that Swami is always with me, right? And that is much, much more precious than the knowledge itself. The confidence that Swami is with me and every step is going to take me forward. The Lord himself is there to guide me. What is there to fear? But at the same time, this knowledge has to be given its due reverence, because we have come to this stage after much, much struggle and after much, much time. In chemistry, when we would do isolation of what we refer to as natural products, you know, we would have to take some leaves or flowers and we would extract, you know, all the distillation and all kinds of, I even forgotten the names of much of those processes, thanks to my life journey, which has taken me away from my subject. But it's a lot of hard labor, you know, you collect enormous amounts of leaves and flowers and we would go on processing it. And after sometimes even months and months of effort, finally you would be left with few milligrams or micrograms of that particular natural product that you have extracted from these leaves and flowers. But when we look at that product, which is probably just a speck in your glassware, that speck represents hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of our effort in the lab, and thousands of rupees of chemicals and apparatus that has gone into making that few milligrams or micrograms of that product. Same is the case with you and me. To be in Swami's presence, we might have seen Swami once, we might have never seen Swami, we might have just heard Swami's voice. Whatever be our, whatever we have received from Swami, that is as precious as that few specks of that compound we get after months and months of extracting. After many, 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 many lifetimes of effort, we are at the doorstep of knowledge itself. Right? And this has to be kept in mind. And that will give the required reverence when we are receiving the message, when we are contemplating on the message. Right? So that is the tone in which these first three shlokas have been given by Lord Krishna. He's preparing Arjuna to receive what is going to be a very, very important knowledge. And in the same way, Krishna is also preparing you and me to receive what is going to be said. So with that, we will go to the fourth verse. And from this point, the actual discourse of jnana and vijnana, as Krishna has promised, actually begins. So we listen to the fourth verse. I'll give you a brief meaning of that, and then we'll discuss in detail what Krishna says here.
भूमिरापो नलो वायुः खं मनो बुद्धिरेव च अहंकार इति यं मे भिन्ना प्रकृतिरष्टधा.
Earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intellect and ego. This is the eightfold division of my manifested nature. That's the fourth verse of the seventh chapter. Krishna begins to explain the nature of creation. Right? You might wonder, I said that this portion is going to be about the nature of God, and I'm saying here that he's talking about the nature of his creation. The most important point is the two are not different. There are different theories for how creation has come to be. In fact, even within the various schools of Vedanta, within Sanatana Dharma, there are different views of how this entire process has come about. But Krishna gives here a very, very specific view. Maybe we'll go deeper into it after we listen to the next shloka as well. But for now, we'll just see what Krishna is saying in this particular shloka. He says, Bhumihi, earth, Apaha, water, Analaha, fire, Vayuhu, air, Kham, ether, Manaha, mind, Buddhihi, intellect, Evacha, and even Ahankaraha, ego or the sense why. Iti, thus, Iyam me prakritihi, this is my nature. Bhinna ashtadha, that is divided eightfold. Krishna states that his nature, or the Supreme Being's nature, divides and manifests itself as this eightfold creation. And as we can clearly see, the first five are the elements, and then we have Mano, Buddhi and Ahankara. These elements, the first five elements, are not the gross water, air and earth that we right now can see. If you go out and see the ocean, when you see the earth that you walk on, we are not referring to those elements. These are referred to as the subtle elements, or the term that is used in Sanskrit is tanmatras. The word tanmatra, a very beautiful and interesting word, it actually is a complex of two words, tat and matra. It means that alone. And this comes from the other concept of how the gross elements come about. There's a process called panchikritam. And through this process, they combine with each other, which means the gross element that we talk of as earth does not have earth alone. It has a little bit of all the other elements, and what we refer to as gross akasha or gross water has a little bit of the other elements through this process of panchikritam. And that is why these are not that element alone, but a combination of all the other elements. These subtle elements are referred to as tanmatras because they are only that element. They do not mix. The mixing has not yet happened. I'm not going to speak about that process fully now because it's quite complex, quite elaborate. In fact, just a few weeks back, we had a video satsang on this theme. The theme was Divine Mysteries. It was a program by Brother Ganesh and Sai Prakash of our team. They explained this very beautifully and very graphically. That video is still available on our YouTube channel. If you're interested to understand this process of panchikritam, what are subtle elements and what are gross elements, I would encourage you to go and have a look at that video, because that is completely based on what Swami says in some of his discourses. Specifically speaking, the 1990 Sambhukos discourse that Swami gives on the three gunas. So much of what they explain there in this process of panchikritam is explained from there. And of course, some of the discourses where Swami speaks about this concept as well. So if some of you want to read more about it, that's the discourse you have to go and look up. 1990 Sambhukos. The chapter's name is The Three Gunas. If you want a little more general and a little more detailed reading, as one of our listeners once pointed out, Adi Shankara's Tattva Bodha, one of the most beautiful works on Advaita Vedanta, there also he explains this process of panchikritam in much detail. But what is interesting in this particular shloka is that Krishna does not speak of prakriti as being fivefold, prapancha, right? When we say the world, the word we use is prapancha, which means this world is made out of five elements. But Krishna is speaking of the prakriti or nature being eightfold, ashtadha, he says. And there's a specific reason for that, which we will see in a moment. And also the order in which he mentions all these eight are also quite specific. He starts with the grossest, leading to the subtlest. Among the elements, Bhumi or earth is supposed to be the most gross. And Akasha, or here he uses the word kham, it is considered to be subtlest, right? Subtler than Akasha, and that's why in the first five elements when he mentions it in that order, right? Bhumi, Apa, and fire, and wind, and so on. Subtler than Akasha is the mind, and subtler than the mind is buddhi or intellect or intelligence, and subtler than even buddhi is ahankara. And needless to say, ahankara here does not mean pride or egotism. It is a sense of individuality, the ego sense or the I sense as we refer to it, right? This means the feeling that I am an individual entity is the subtlest aspect of creation that is within this nature. And this entire dream of creation and having this universe and this prapancha, is all of that is based on this sense of separation or ahankara. And that's why that's the most subtle. As I was saying, this is slightly different from the way creation is spoken of in some other schools of philosophy, and even from the point of view of the theories of creation that other religions speak about as well. And the entire idea of Vedanta is based on this unique theory that is being explained by Krishna. We will listen to the next shloka also, and then we will discuss what makes it unique and what Krishna is saying. In fact, what we heard in this particular shloka is not complete. This shloka and the next shloka together completes what Krishna is explaining about Prakriti or nature. So we'll listen to the next shloka as well, that is the fifth shloka, and then we will discuss what Krishna is saying here about how creation has come to be and how that's a very important model in understanding. And keep the overall picture in your mind, right, as I read out that portion from Gita Vahini, why Krishna is explaining this whole part. The whole idea is to drive a more important and subtle message. We will discuss that probably in the end of today's program. But keep that in mind, that the whole idea is to, the overall idea of the Bhagavad Gita itself is eventually that you should be able to perform your karmas with an enlightened attitude as a karma yogi, right? And for that, Swami says Shraddha Bhakti is important, and for Shraddha Bhakti to understand these concepts are important, right? So it is always important to remember that underlying thread of this entire discourse. So we listen to the fifth verse of the seventh chapter, and then we'll discuss what Krishna is conveying in the fourth and fifth shlokas together.
Apareyamitastvanyam Prakritim Vidhi Me Param Jiva Bhutam Mahabaho Yayedam Dharyate Jagat.
O mighty armed one, this is the inferior Prakriti. Know the other Prakriti of mine, which, however, is higher than this, which has taken the form of individual souls, and by which this world is upheld. So that's the fifth verse of the seventh chapter. Krishna introduces the concept of two Prakritis, a lower one and a higher one, Apara Prakriti and Para Prakriti. The word Para means beyond or supreme, and Apara then becomes its antonym, its opposite of that, which means ordinary or something that is more simple, right? So when Krishna speaks of, so what Krishna speaks of as the eightfold creation, he says it is Apara Prakriti. He says Apara Iham. This is ordinary or lower, Apara. Tu Itaha Anyam Prakritim. Whereas the Prakriti that is other than this, Anyam Prakritim. Vidhi Me Param. Know that to be supreme. Right? So he says, whatever I've been telling now, I've told you eightfold creation, that is Apara Prakriti, that is simple, ordinary, but know that there is another Prakriti, and that is the Supreme Prakriti, and that he is going to explain what it is. He says, Jiva Bhutam, that which is the essence of all jivas or all life forms. Yaya, by which Idam Jagat, this entire world, Dharyate, is upheld. So let me now get back to what I said during the previous shloka as being unique in this explanation that Krishna is giving. Generally, Prakriti is spoken of as nature or creation that either comes about because of God's Maya, or it is spoken of as something created by God. Here Krishna clearly says that the material world as well as the soul or Atma both have come from him, or he himself has become that. Both are his Prakriti. But what is referred to as lower manifestation or Apara Prakriti is given to constant change and modification, right? Whatever Krishna said, the five elements, even Mano, Buddhi and Ahankara, all of these undergo modifications constantly. Of course, the elements, we know they undergo modification. Even if you're talking about the subtle elements, they undergo modification to form the gross elements. The gross elements further undergo modifications to see whatever we are seeing, right? From mountains, hills, trees, all of that is nothing but a play of the five elements. Something that Swami says multiple times in his discourses. Whatever that you see is nothing but a play of the five elements. So when Krishna says those five elements, they're constantly changing. They're given to constant modification. Even the other three that Swami says, Mano, Buddhi and Ahankara, they are also given to modifications. How does the Ahankara undergo modification? That's the subtlest, right? Does that also undergo modification? Certainly it does. As Swami says, this ego sense, it is nothing but, you know, when you, the word literally Ahankara means, Aham means I am. So Ahankara means I amness. That's probably the closest in English you can define the word Ahankara. So that I amness, it's almost like that Aham is floating there and it constantly attaches itself to different things. This ego sense, it attaches to various objects, what we refer to as anatma. It attaches to the body. It attaches to the youthfulness of the body. It attaches to the talents that this body and this mind have. It attaches to the failures. It attaches to the relationships. And this constantly undergoes modification, and we only have to look at ourselves. What I define myself as when I was a 5-year-old is completely different from what I define myself as a 35-year-old or a 40-year-old, right? That I amness has changed so much, right? Till this aham eventually attaches itself to the soul and it says, aham brahmasmi. Till that point in time, even this ahankara undergoes constant modification. And if you go through the process that is referred to as panchikritam, that Swami had explained, we'll see all these senses, pranas, and all of that are nothing but the play of these tanmatras. So in this human presence that we all are, this complex of body, mind, and atma, mind and body are those that come under apara prakriti because they are constantly undergoing modification. And Krishna says, the Atma alone is para prakriti. This is often explained with two other words, very important words, which Swami also had used in that passage that I read out from Gita Vahini, and I said we're going to come back to these words. In fact, the English translation of the Gita Vahini do not have these words as often as they should. If you listen to the original Telugu, you will find that Swami uses these two words. He says, I'm going to explain my Swabhava and Swarupa. Swabhava literally means nature. If you say that such and such a person has a Shanta Swabhava, it means that he has a peaceful demeanor. So it is not the person, but the quality of the person. Here what Krishna speaks of as eightfold apara prakriti is God's Swabhava. The other word is Swarupa. Though literally Swarupa is translated as God's form or a person's form, and we always associate form with something that is changing, nama and rupa, right? But here when Krishna says Swarupa, it means the true form of Lord. So Swabhava is what is projected and that which undergoes change, and Swarupa is what is true and that which is unchanging. The whole idea of this description is to make it very, very clear that everything is divine, right? So that is the bottom line. Why is Krishna explaining this whole thing about his Swabhava and Swarupa, about these two prakritis, para and apara? The whole idea is to drive this thought that everything is divine. Whatever we see in this world is divine, because they all have come from the same divine being. But there is a slight difference. One is changeless and one is constantly changing. And when we go after that which is constantly changing, when we associate ourselves with the changing world, there will be pain and sorrow, right? That's what Krishna spoke about in the beginning, in the second chapter. That which is changing, that which is given to the Shad Vikaras, as Krishna said, which is born, which dies, which ages, which transforms. When you attach your mind to that, you will be given to sorrow. Whereas this para prakriti is pure and unchanging. It never undergoes any modification. Two other words that Swami uses to describe these are adhara and adheya. One that is the foundation and the other that is based on this foundation. For example, if you look at all the life forms on earth, trees, plants, birds, animals and humans and everyone, if you look at them as adheya, they all come and go because nobody is constant on the surface of this earth. Then the earth with its relative constancy becomes the adhara. The earth is the adhara and all life forms are adheya. They live on it and then they perish. Similarly, there must have been many planets like earth which were formed and then existed for a period of time and then dissolved in time, right? If you were to look at it that way, then the earth becomes adheya and probably the galaxy becomes adhara. And similarly, this entire universe that we see, this entire cosmos that you see, though it has a huge lifespan, which is probably a few billion years, it also has a starting point and it also has an ending point. So if this entire visible universe is seen as adheya, then there must be something which is the adhara for this entire universe. So all that is visible, if we refer to that as adheya, that becomes apara prakriti, and God's swarupa, which is param prakriti, becomes the adhara or the foundation for this entire seen prakriti. That is why Krishna says in this shloka, yayedam dharyate jagat, that which is the dhara, that which upholds this entire jagat. And jagat, as Swami has explained so beautifully in his many discourses, jagat, ja-gat, Swami would say, that which comes and goes. So for that which comes and goes, which is the adheya, yayedam dharyate jagat, that jagat, for that adhara, is this param prakriti. And which sustains all this, that Param Prakriti is the Swarupa of the Lord. And another important point that Krishna makes and is certainly going to deliberate on is the fact that our Swarupa is also the same. Because that is what Krishna has been saying ever since the second chapter, right? The entire second chapter was on how Krishna was telling Arjuna that you never die, you can never get killed. In fact, not only you, none of these people in this battlefield are going to be killed, because none of them are these bodies, none of them are these mind, right? That is why this is a very, very beautiful explanation that Krishna gives. He says, the five elements, along with Mano, Buddhi and Ahankara, which we otherwise relate to ourselves, right? With a little bit of thinking, I always say this, with a little bit of thinking and inquiry, we can dismiss the idea that I am this body. It probably requires only a few minutes of serious and sincere thinking. You know that so much the body undergoes change, and in fact it is undergoing change even as we are speaking and listening, right? So it is very easy to dissociate this ahankara from the body, though that body consciousness never goes away, but at least mentally we can dissociate ourselves from the body. But it takes much, much more effort to dissociate ourselves from Mano, Buddhi and Ahankara. So even this Manas, Buddhi and Ahankara, Swami says, is part of that Prakriti which is changing, which is not who you really are, right? And this is going to be explained in different ways through this chapter and many chapters. And another two words that Krishna is going to use is Kshetra and Kshetrajna, the field and the knower of the field. We'll again come to that. I think that comes in one of the later chapters. So the whole concept is based on these two Prakritis that Krishna speaks about. The Para Prakriti, which is the Supreme Prakriti, which is the Swarupa of the Lord, the true form, and then the Apara Prakriti, which has become all that we see, the elements, the seas, and everything. And in even those that we have not seen, as Swami would say, the 14 lokas, 7 lokas above, 7 lokas below, Atala, Sutala, Tala, Atala, Patala, and all of that, right? Swarga and everything. Even all of that we have no knowledge about, all of that also gets contained in what is referred to as Apara Prakriti. And as the soul, he literally is living through all of these. And there are going to be the next 3-4 shlokas, some very beautiful and clear analogies that Krishna is going to give to explain this concept of how there is a seen and there is an unseen. Right now our problem is we are relating to the seen, and the whole idea is to associate with the unseen and believe that that is what we really are, right? And that is the true understanding that Krishna is trying to impart through jnana and vijnana. So you might wonder, oh, so we already know that. But that knowing is not so simple. That knowing has to seep into experience. That knowing has to become a part of our living experience, right? So that is what sadhana is all about. And that is what we are doing this, what we are doing right now. Whether it's me speaking or you listening, what we are trying to do is the process of shravana and manana. Hopefully, nididhyasana will also happen by Swami's grace. So with that, we'll conclude this week's episode, dear listeners. We'll continue with the 7th chapter next week. Do join me again. Give me the pleasure of your company on this Triune Pilgrimage, the Gita series. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the last segment of today's Thursday Live, the Vahini Satsang. Before I leave, let me remind you that this weekend we are celebrating the 9th anniversary of Radio Sai Telugu Stream, and we have some wonderful programs lined up. Especially if you follow the language of Telugu, you please keep your weekend absolutely blocked, because on Saturday we're going to have an entire day of programs by children from different places in Andhra and Telangana. And on Sunday we're going to have programs by our volunteers and devotees from different parts of, again, Andhra and Telangana. And apart from the Telugu programs, we have some wonderful music programs, wonderful instrumental and vocal renditions by children. You don't need to understand the language to enjoy those. So these programs will be on the Sri Satya Sai Sandesha Jhari, which is the Telugu channel of our YouTube offerings, or you can tune in to the Radio Sai Telugu stream. So I'll leave you with that. Till I meet you all next week, take care, keep safe. Jai Sai Ram.